we have all these little movements around food issues, but we're not all coalescing as one. Is there something wrong with this overall system that it is, you know, not that it's harming the environment, that it's harming public health? Workers aren't being paid well. And in fact, you know, during COVID, so many are getting sick and dying. It's failing on a bunch of places. It's delivering on cheap food, which is one priority, but it's not delivering on others. So I think that is really a motivating piece behind this. And I think the other motivating piece is the fact that the current way that we regulate food is so fragmented.
It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
If what we need is a food strategy, how are we going to get there? Well, there is a blueprint for such a thing. In large part, it's thanks to my guest, Professor Emily Broadlieb, and she's the faculty director of food law and policy at the Harvard University. Or should I say Harvard College? I always get that wrong.
Harvard Law School.
Ah, Harvard Law School. Well, Professor Broadlieb, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
There's so many places that I want to be able to explore with you today. For one, being able to be at the Harvard Law School and be focused on food. A lot of law schools don't have anything like that. How does it come to be that this is an area of focus at Harvard Law School?
It's great. Really good question. And actually, I'll maybe answer that in two pieces, one of which is how my program came to be and then what this looks like at other schools. So my clinic is the first clinic at a law school in the US that was focused on the food system. And what it means to be a clinic is that my real main role is teaching students in the classroom, but the primary work is teaching them hands-on by working on different projects and advising government agencies, nonprofits, coalitions about the laws that structure the food system and helping them answer their questions. So the way that my program came about was that after graduating from Harvard Law School, I wound up spending some time in rural Mississippi, and I was working on kind of health and economic development issues. And I learned from community partners there that there were lots of local kind of food businesses and farmers markets that were facing a bunch of legal questions. And my first project was helping them get answers to those, because lawyers are expensive. It's hard to answer these questions without someone providing those services. So I think I learned really quickly, there are a lot of questions. And not only that, there are a lot of pressures on the way that we regulate food, because people want to see different things. They want food to be healthier. They want more transparency. They want it to be better for the environment. All of these things are kind of in a crucible coming together and really putting pressure on us to understand and improve the laws around the food system. So that's in a nutshell. I then had to convince my colleagues that it was a worthwhile endeavor. But what I found in my own research is actually that there's a growing number of law schools teaching and offering programming in this field, because it is of growing interest.
When I think of putting Harvard Law School together with any place, I don't think of Southern Mississippi or having that connection, because, I mean, there's a certain image of Harvard Law School. There's been all sorts of TV programs and movies and videos, and it's a beautiful place, especially we're approaching the fall. I've been on the campus there before, and man, you really get a special feeling about it, but it has a certain image. On the other hand, rural Mississippi has many issues, according to, you know, there's high unemployment, there's poverty issues. They're one of the places that have a lot of challenges, I guess. Yeah. So how did you happen to find yourself in Southern Mississippi?
Yes. Well, not Southern Mississippi, but rural Mississippi. I was actually in Northwest Mississippi.
So Northwest. Okay.
The Mississippi Delta region, which a lot of people, in, you know, without knowing much about the place, think the Delta is by the water. Normally a Delta is like a, you know, in the ocean, but the Mississippi Delta is actually the floodplains of the Mississippi River. So it's this like extraordinarily flat landscape with amazing soil, because it used to be for hundreds of years, the Mississippi River flooded there. And it's a region of the state that was developed somewhat late in terms of the state of Mississippi, and by a lot of large plantations kind of post-Civil War. So the region of the state has even greater like inequality than I think the rest of the state, which is really a lot to process. So the you're right that there are a lot of challenges. When I was there, I wasn't working particularly on food. I was hired by a consortium of university partners that were researching the kind of poor economic and health and educational outcomes in the region. And the idea was that they wanted to have someone on the ground connecting all of this university research to what are communities really saying that they want? And you know, how can we, you know, use this resource, these resources, this data that we're collecting in research, and help translate it into impact and programs on the ground? So it's, you know, it was a really interesting thing. It's a really weird thing to do out of law school. I remember getting a lot of like side-eye glances from my colleagues and my family and family friends saying, you know, you just graduated from Harvard Law School. You're not going to a law firm. You're not going to the government. You're going to go post up in this random little town and just kind of help build community connections. And it was just amazing. I mean, there's so much kind of innovation and creativity within the community. And a lot of it is bringing resources to these local solutions and helping them move forward. So when I didn't only work on food issues, but that was the piece that I really learned the most about. And then I saw, looking forward, this is a place where everyone is starting to think about these issues, because they're at the crux of so many of our social challenges that we're facing that impact the economy and health and the environment. So that was really the piece I took forward. But while I was there, I worked on transportation. I worked on some other healthcare issues, like around infant mortality and perinatal care, which is another huge issue in Mississippi, and particularly in the Delta, this high rates of infant mortality and particularly high racial disparities in infant mortality and poor birth outcomes. I worked on small business development. So I started like a little small business kind of incubation training thing with a business professor from University of Mississippi. And we were training and giving resources to just all kinds of small businesses. But food was the piece that really opened my eyes, just to see that there's on both sides of it, whether on the production side and on the consumer side, there's so many questions and not a lot of expertise at that time to be able to answer those questions. And so I found myself a really, you know, good, interesting area that's keeping me occupied.
Well, you know what? I would ask the same question of you that your friends did, because, again, when somebody goes through, graduates from Harvard Law School, and you could go to Wall Street and be a zillionaire, or, you know, go into government and have power if that's what you're after. But you took this other path. I'm curious, that leading into Harvard Law School, were you kind of mission driven at that time? Were you going in to become a lawyer because you wanted to have some impact of some sort on society? What drove you there in the first place?
I definitely went in with a kind of mission driven goal. But I think what's really interesting is actually a lot of law students go into law school with this mission orientation. And I think it's a lot easier to even coming in with that inclination to go to a law firm. And I mean, I really saw that, like, you know, a lot of my friends had their jobs lined up, you know, almost a year before I did. And I was still trying to figure out what I would do. That said, I will just say I did work one summer at a law firm in New York. I actually spent half of the time in their New York office and half in their Paris office. So I got wined and dined and had this great, you know, big law experience. And so I had an offer to go back there, and I knew that wasn't really what I wanted to do, but I had a little bit of a backup plan in place. Mm-hmm. And the reason that I wound up in Mississippi was, in law school, I did mostly global work, and I wanted to do more kind of international rule of law and human rights. And my then boyfriend, who is my now husband, had some health issues. So I was trying to find a way to do the same kind of work, but domestically, instead of taking him someplace where healthcare would have been more of a challenge and the language barrier. So it was, you know, it wasn't what I had expected to do, but I really fell in love with the partners that I was working with and with this idea that by bringing together different disciplines and that kind of academic and community piece in an area where almost any direction you look, you can have an impact. And that was what was both beautiful but really hard about working there too, was that every conversation I had, it was like, I can see ways that just bringing a little bit of resources and attention to this problem could have an impact. And so, and then I think taking that a step further, the way I wound up back at Harvard Law School was that in the 2 years I was there, I engaged 60 Harvard Law students to work on different projects with me on food, on all these different issues. So I think the school realized at the end that there was also a demand on the part of students that wanted to do more community work, community development, using these legal skills we were learning, but really connected to, you know, benefiting community partners. And so that was eye-opening to me, because it was something that wasn't necessarily part of my law school training. I had to figure it out on the ground, but a lot of my work now is training students to do this exact kind of thing. Like, how do you, as an outsider and as a lawyer and as a Harvard lawyer, which, you know, already you're so, I think going into doing work with communities, you can be perceived as being so distant and removed. I mean, how do you really listen and kind of provide support to clients and partners that is really understanding and you know, meeting the goals that they have?
Well, you know, we're going to get back up to Harvard and what you're actually doing. But before I do, I still am just intrigued about getting your law degree and then driving to Mississippi. So what'd you do? Kind of load up a U-Haul or something and you go down and you try to find an apartment or someplace you can stay with somebody until you can find someone permanent and have to figure out the coffee shop and where's the stores and all that stuff?
Oh, you don't even know the half of it. It was complicated. But we did have a really good partner on the ground in Clarksdale, Mississippi, which was where I lived for those 2 years. So the trick was, at the time, the university I was partnered with was Mississippi State University, which is all the way across the state, 2.5 hours away. So they said, you know, we're here, we're paying your salary, we have all the supports for you, but we're not in the same town. So we had a great local partner that actually helped us find housing, but, you know, it was an adventure. You know, things don't always work the way they're supposed to. And I think I also really appreciated the experience living in a really small town in a really rural area, because, and I think this is true, not just for food, but for so many areas of policy, that you have to really spend the time to understand how these things play out in some of these communities. But there were some days where I was like, how can I get any work done in these conditions? Because it was just a different, you know.
And I would imagine there's not a lot of similarities between Clarksburg and Cambridge, Massachusetts. But what do they have in common? Was there anything in common?
What was in common? Not that much. I think, you know, a couple of takeaways for me. One was really that I thought I was going to have so much free time when I was there, because I was thinking there's not going to be that much to do. There's not, you know, museums and concerts and events. But on the flip side, I found that being in a smaller community, I felt like I wanted to attend more of the things that were going on. So I went to like town hall meetings and community development meetings. And, you know, I filled my time with some of the things that I maybe wouldn't have been as involved in a larger town. And so, in some ways, even though I only spent 2 years there, and I've now spent, between law school and teaching, 13 of my years in the Cambridge and Boston area, I felt like, you know, I got really engaged in that community and felt really, had like a real stake in what was going on there. So that was really interesting. I think people come from different backgrounds, but at base have the same goals, which are to, you know, do well for themselves and their families and their communities. And, they're just coming to it with a little bit different perspective. The other thing that was a takeaway for me after leaving Mississippi and coming back to Massachusetts was a lot of my work early on and still now has been state and local. But what I found was if there's some issue that's the same in both rural Mississippi and in, you know, Massachusetts, then we know we have a real opportunity for policy change, because these are the things that are really, you know, we can kind of bring to Congress, bring to the agencies, bring to the White House and say, all over the country, there are these issues with the way we're regulating food right now. And I feel confident saying, you know, I've talked to people in both places coming with very different backgrounds and very different experiences, but this is a barrier that both sets are facing, and there's something we can do to deal with these systemic issues.
So you're back in Harvard then, and you start teaching classes right off the bat. Were you teaching classes that related to food and had a food focus to them, or food policy focus, as you're back in Harvard?
When I first came back to Harvard, this is, you know, my young self, so this was me 2 years out of law school, I said, I want to start my own clinic. Thank you very much. And the law school sort of said, you can come and work in an existing program. And so there was some discussion about what was the right fit. So I spent the first year as a fellow in our health policy clinic, which is now our partner. We have separate programs for students, but we do a lot of work. And as you can imagine, food and the healthcare system are really intertwined. And then after a year of that, I was able to put together a syllabus and start teaching and kind of engaging students in food in its own right. And I think one of the things that was a real experience for me was educating my colleagues at the law school about how important and how expansive the regulation of food actually is. And I think, you know, I remember my first year back here as a fellow talking to some of my colleagues and saying, well, I'm in our health policy program, but I'm really working on food. And they said, oh, that's such a small topic. Are you helping get more microgreens at farmers markets? And it took me at least 5 years to really get the support behind the fact that I'm looking at the 40% of food that we waste in this country, and the, you know, how do we actually really align incentives and educate so that that goes somewhere else? And I'm looking at the, food insecurity and the way that, you know, technology is impacting access to be able to use food benefits and who that's helping and harming. I was able to get things started, and I'm grateful that the law school was flexible enough that with support of my then boss, now colleague, I was able to kind of move things along. But it took me some time to really convince the academy that this was a worthwhile endeavor and not only that, but an essential one for our society for a lot of reasons.
So when you talk about a food system, that's it's so huge. I mean, we talk about food systems and we need to change the food systems. It sounds like you're especially looking at the food after it leaves the farm, perhaps. You're not trying to, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but you're not trying to necessarily get corn and soybean farmers to switch over to organic arugula or something.
It's all part of this.
Is it really?
It is. It's huge. That's what I'm saying. Like, they were like, oh, what a small space. And it was like, it's quite the contrary. It is really massive. My theory of change on this, and it's kind of relevant to our national food strategy, which we can get into, but also not just that, it's my theory of change that's relevant to even the most small scale policies that we're working on, is that these are interconnected, and to make good recommendations and good policies, you have to see those connections. Even if every policy doesn't address all of them, even, you know, if you don't have in mind the way that pulling one lever is going to impact these systems, then I don't think you can really do a good job in regulating. So just to give you like my sense of what the field encompasses, what I teach in class is that broad sweep. We start with food safety regulation, labeling, marketing. We talk about the First Amendment, which has had growing impact on regulation of a lot of commercial enterprise, but in the food space in particular. And then I talk about environmental regulation of food and agriculture, the farm bill, subsidies, genetic engineering and patenting of seeds and farm products, agricultural products. And then more on the consumer side, the dietary guidelines, diet-related disease, food security, food access. So, you know, and sprinkled in there is a little bit of animal welfare, a little bit of you know, not a little bit, but workers like the, you know, protection or lack thereof of workers throughout the food supply. And then we work on a lot of these things in different projects. But I think to me, the students need to understand how these interrelate so that they can do good work for our clients on their specific project.
Wow. You know, when you start describing all of it, it just is overwhelming. I spend all my time talking about food and agriculture, and I am overwhelmed, you know, when you look at and now you could have even added COVID to it, too.
Yep. Actually teaching a new reading group this fall that's called Provisioning in the Pandemic. And it's a micro course, but it's really about how COVID is changing the food system. So it's actually been really fun. And I think fun for the students to be like reading really current news about this and talking about how this is impacting and the short term and the long term, the issues in the food system.
You have a broad range of areas that you're able to address. Now, when you do this and you're teaching your students, are you identifying this is the way it is right now, and these are the ways that the current laws and regulations affect them, and then do you suggest to them these are some paths forward that if the laws change, these are some other opportunities?
Yes. So it is, and I would say, you know, another of my learnings as a student and then with the students that I interacted with early on in my time in Mississippi and then coming back was that they are really interested in policy change. A lot of people go to law school wanting to work on policy change. And I think until recently, that wasn't necessarily what we were giving students. So I think I would say my class is they're doing some of the black letter law, which is like the basic, you know, what are the words of the statute? You know, reading some court cases, but a lot of it is more about, okay, what are the big debates around policy right now and how can we think about them? Like, why are they tricky? You know, I'm not necessarily saying in most cases, here's what I think we should do, you know, posing challenges and then why are some of the different solutions tricky? One thing I do in my class that I love is that all the students have to participate in a role play of a debate on a policy issue. So they are assigned to represent different viewpoints, which include radically different takes on issues. So this past week, we did one that was I was talking about the policy idea of restricting marketing of certain food products to children. So there were four students had to participate. The rest of the class listens to their opening statement, reads their written statement, and then asks questions. But the students represented food industry, the marketing and advertising industry, the nonprofit sector, and then like the kind of science and public health sector. And they each gave their statement. And then we kind of got into like, and, you know, it turns up a lot of these questions around, well, what is good evidence? Whose evidence? Is self-regulation sufficient or do we need government regulation? And if we do, are there constitutional limits on that, like First Amendment protection. So even though we're covering a lot of content, you know, I think we're uncovering some of these issues that you have to think about no matter what policies you might move forward and who are the key players that are at the table, that kind of thing. And then the students also, their final project for the class is that they pick a policy topic of their choosing and write a paper kind of aimed at convincing a government agency, you know, our Congress to do something. And then half of the students in class then go on to do the clinic. And the clinic is, we have actual clients. So, you know, we're I'm trying to think what project I have right now. I mean, one of our projects is that we, and this was a funded project, but is to help local and state governments and, you know, community coalitions develop more policies that reduce the demand for sugar consumption.
Right.
So those were communities applied to us. We each year have had either two or three communities that we worked hands-on with them around, what do you really want to see? Who is your coalition? What are they? What policies actually would make sense? What legal restrictions might there be? Like, in particular, if you're operating at the local level, there's, you know, you can't, not every city has the same, level of authority because of what, you know, depending on the state law. So those are the kinds of things we're doing in the clinic. And that takes us all over the place. We're looking at, you know, what different nonprofits or government agencies want our help with. Or in another one we're doing for, this is for a group in Mississippi that we've worked with for years. They wanted us to do some trainings kind of related to COVID. They're seeing more work on food donation and food pantries from organizations that typically weren't doing that, but the need is so great. And we're doing some legal trainings for them about the laws in Mississippi on rescuing and donating food.
You were describing these cases that your students get into, and they're having to argue this point of view and that point of view. And we're not doing much of that anymore as a society. You know, I'm glad you're doing it in law school, but it's kind of like you're in this camp or you're in that camp, and that means that you're
not talking
from this side. You know, you're against GMOs in general, or if you're on this side, you're for taxing sugar. You know, and I'm against subsidy programs, or I'm for this. But that kind of interaction that you're describing seems really, really a healthy thing to actually have some strong discussions and having on that sort of thing. And that kind of maybe is a way we can transition now back into the blueprint. Why is there a blueprint for the food system, and what are you doing with that? And in fact, I think you said that you've done some drafts on it and it had one report out, and you're in the process of updating that report to explain that.
Yeah, great. Yeah, I mean, and I think to this point we've been talking about, to me, there's two ways you can approach the challenges that are facing the food system. One is by these kind of incremental projects, which I think are really important. And I feel like that is where we've seen a lot of success. And the other is by saying, is there something wrong with this overall system that it is, you know, not that it's harming the environment, that it's harming public health, workers aren't being paid well. And in fact, you know, during COVID, so many are getting sick and dying. It's failing on a bunch of places. It's delivering on cheap food, which is one priority, but it's not delivering on others. So I think that is really a motivating piece behind this. And I think the other motivating piece is the fact that the current way that we regulate food is so fragmented. So at the federal level alone, there are 15 different agencies that regulate some portion of food safety. The biggest two are the Food and Drug Administration and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, but like the Environmental Protection Agency has a role in some issues. The CDC has a role. CDC actually was the agency that just put out guidance on safety for vendors and consumers in farmers markets and food distribution sites. So it's really spread out. And then there's also some decision making that happens at the state and local level as well. So I think the idea behind this was to say, it doesn't have to be this way. I mean, it'd be hard to get away from all of these agencies playing a role because they have their different expertise, but there's not a reason that they couldn't do a little bit more strategic thinking together. So our initial blueprint report, which we published, as you said, in 2017, was looking at two different sets of models. One was other countries that have created a national food strategy. We looked at six countries, including the UK, Scotland, Brazil, Norway. And then the other set of models were other national strategies we have in the US. And the crazy part there was that we have so many. We pulled up We had 60 we were choosing from. We picked 8 to like really dig deep on them. But this is a thing we do in the US. We say that we have an issue and we create a strategy to figure out how are we going to muster support, make change, to align on priorities and get input on what those should be so that government, our federal government, isn't in a vacuum trying to decide what to do. So the blueprint really went through all of those in quite comprehensive detail and pulled out a couple main recommendations. The biggest one was really, we kind of went into it saying, we're not sure at the end of this if we're going to recommend the creation of a strategy in the US, but at the end we said, we definitely need this. All of the issues we're seeing about, you know, so many of the things we're talking about were motivating factors for other countries creating strategies. One of the biggest being, like the UK, for example, said, we have too many agencies regulating food. We need one combined strategy so that they all have marching orders as to what they should be doing. So that just really resonates with me in understanding the kind of challenges that we have here. Some of them, it was really about getting input from consumers as to what they wanted to see in their food system. And if, you know, making food more sustainable meant that some costs would go up, like, is that an okay trade-off to make? So we really distilled that into some major recommendations about how to structure the strategy. And that is what the blueprint is. If the U.S. is going to create a strategy, here are the things we need to do. We published it in 2017. As you know, here we are in 2020. We do not have a national food strategy for the U.S. The one good thing that happened was that Canada read our report and said, this is great. What a nice blueprint. And they took the blueprint and fairly faithfully like implemented the steps of it. And they launched a strategy last year. They included thousands of you know, input from different community members and nonprofits through in-person discussions and online. And then the government actually appropriated funds to meet some of the priorities. Like it helped people align over here are the places we need to fund. So there was some more support given to local infrastructure, more support given to First Nations that we have huge issues in our, you know, Native American communities as well, where like the diet-related disease, food security, you know, so they had similar challenges. And they gave money to food waste reduction. And it was, I think, a really successful endeavor. So here we are, we're in the midst of writing an update report. And the goal of this is to say, not that we have new recommendations, because our recommendations are the same. We know what would make a successful strategy. It's more about everything that's happened in these 3.5 years has shown even more greatly how much we need a strategy. And we now have this example from Canada to add into our mix of showing the success of this. So, you know, I can get into more detail of some of the things we're covering. Not surprisingly, there's a big section about COVID-19 and how in many, many different ways it hasn't created new problems in the food system, but it's exacerbated a lot of the challenges that we knew were there and has made them more visible.
You know, I think it's really interesting that Canada jumped on your idea, but they've done so many interesting things up there. I've been impressed. I got a lot of listeners of Farm to Table Talk in Canada, and they have been moving forward on so many interesting programs and progressive programs. So I'm really in a way not surprised.
Yeah.
I'm wondering about your interaction with state level regulations. Mm-hmm. I mean, one issue I find around the country is that people that have small farms that would like to be able to do more direct local marketing, especially with livestock, it's almost impossible to get meat processed because you've got the federal regulations that are pretty tough for smaller plants to do. But in fact, for these smaller scale farms that utilize grazing opportunities all over the country, they really need to have some more flexibility to actually make it possible to have local processing plants. Have you touched on that issue at all?
Yeah, it's definitely been, you know, on our radar. And I think I will say I think that it's another one where there were people sounding the alarm about this issue before COVID-19, but that it's brought it much more to the forefront. And I think you know, put it on the radar more at the federal level too, that having these shutdowns in major meat processing has shown that our food system is less resilient when so much of the processing goes through these like few key plants rather than being more distributed. So I know that that's on the radar. I will say, I think National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition has worked on this, and a shout out to our former intern, Kelly Knuckles, who's there, who this has been a thing she's, you know, among others there has been working on. But I think the interesting thing with that is that you frame it as a state and local issue, which it is to some extent, but part of it is that the federal government isn't giving a lot of authority to state and local government to regulate meat processing. The federal government has said you have to, for any meat and poultry processing, you know, there's some small exemptions, but you have to have it slaughtered and processed in a federally inspected facility, unless you have a state inspection program. But we will only allow you to have a state inspection program that's equally as strict as the federal program. So it doesn't leave a lot of wiggle room for some of the smaller facilities, because they have to be, for slaughter, you're paying someone to be there full time, you know, the entire day when you're processing. So I do think that I agree with you 100% on this issue. And I think we, you know, with time and the ability to look back and maybe say now, this might not really be needed for safety. And in fact, there might be other ways to meet some of the safety goals we have that are achievable by smaller scale producers, and that actually the risks are lower with some of these smaller scale facilities, because when you look at like the line speed that the large facility that they keep increasing the line speed, I mean, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to imagine that even having a person there full time is really making that so much safer.
Yeah, I just heard an interesting idea the other day. They were saying that these really large meat processing plants, not just going back to the smaller levels of the state, but they should just be made smaller. I mean, if you could end up having one of the current plants today be turned into four different plants, more dispersed in the country, taking into consideration where the production is and where the consumers are and so forth, that they would be able to manage them more safely if that could happen.
Yeah. And I think, you know, again, not, you know, bringing it back to this idea of taking this system-wide lens, it's sort of saying, what's the snapshot of where we are now? And I think recognizing that doing things like that may actually increase the cost to some extent, but we're so afraid of increasing the cost that I think it's hampering our ability to do things that are better for the long term. And I think that there's other ways to address those. So it's saying we need to pair that policy with this other one, like whether it's incentives for on the business, on the kind of supply side, the business side, or whether it's saying, you know, the cost of meat will go up for some period of time. We're going to then increase the benefit for SNAP for that, you know, period of time too. I mean, none of these things should be impossible to do on their own. It just, I think, takes a little bit of this vision around how can we break down this barrier that we're so afraid of you know, like short-term impacts that we're unable to look to the long-term.
So you're identifying all these issues of the food system, and you're identifying what the current policy is, and you're suggesting how the policies could be improved. Now, it seems to me that has to be handed off to a politician.
Yes.
And that somebody has to say, these are good ideas. I am going to introduce a bill in Congress, or am I going to introduce one in the Massachusetts or Mississippi legislature? Mm-hmm. And are you getting that? Are you involved in that handoff and working with politicians that want to, in fact, make the laws and change the regulations with what you've suggested?
Yeah. So one thing that's interesting with our blueprint report and the update is that we decided and my colleague, I also need to mention Lori Bay Renovan, who's at Vermont Law School in their Center for Agriculture and Food Systems. So we've been, you know, working on this since the beginning. Our thought process was, you know, lots of people are out there, including ourselves in our other work, recommending specific policies. The blueprint was really more about saying we need to start a national dialogue to identify which of those policies should go forward. But it's very focused on process and not on the substance. And that doesn't mean that I don't have it in my back pocket and all over our website. You know, we put out a report in this summer in April that was, here are the top things we think Congress needs to do in the next stimulus, whenever that might be, for the food system. Here's what we need to do for SNAP, for WIC, for school meals, for food waste and donation. So those are out there. This is much more about, we need the buy-in and we need to kind of get the different stakeholders at the table to figure out what are these priorities and how do we navigate kind of policymaking around them jointly together. And I think it's partly also like responding to this. I think about, you know, Michael Pollan wrote in 2010, and he's just amazing, but just about how we have all these little movements around food issues, but we're not all coalescing as one. And here we are 20 years later, and I think we could say the same is still true. We may have, there may be shared goals, but people are very focused on their own kind of piece of the puzzle. And I think while we can move forward on those pieces one by one, there's also an opportunity to say, how do we look at these together a little bit more strategically and prioritize as you know, a set of interested stakeholders and with input for consumers, general consumers as well, as to what they want the future to look like in the food system.
So who are these stakeholders? Are they the farm organizations? Are they consumer organizations? Are they environmental organizations? Are they organizations at all?
I think that's what's hard about it. But it's also, again, we've seen other countries do this and we've been able to do it on other issues. So it's not impossible. We would come up with a lot of information, but our push is really, this needs to be a government endeavor. And in a big, the most important component of it is coordinating amongst the many federal agencies that are now working on these issues. And then getting the input from these various stakeholders who otherwise are at odds with one another. How do we get them to find the places where there can be agreement so that, you know, 10 years from now, we look back and we say, okay, we have a more distributed food system that's more resilient. You know, maybe prices of food went up a little bit, but workers in the food system are paid well enough, so now they can afford food themselves. Right now, food workers have double the rate of food insecurity of the general population. That's a huge externalized cost of the food system. It doesn't make any sense. So, you know, like in the future, we're not stuck there. It's not that these things can't be changed. It's sort of thinking about it a little bit longer term and putting some of those policies together. And I think our push is really that the White House or Congress through legislation should create an office or a commission that's really going to look at this and take that input in and then come back and say to Congress or the president, here's what we need to do. Here's a package of policies that need to be passed all together to address some of these issues. So I know it's hard to wrap your head around, but we wouldn't be the first to do it. And it is possible. And I am, you know, maybe an idealist about it a little bit, but I do think that what we've also seen is that often a national kind of crisis or disaster have led to these. Like the 9/11 commission was created by Congress after 9/11 to say, we have these fragmented national security agencies. What do we need to do to bring this together and make sure we don't have something like this happen again? And I think COVID is doing something like that to the food system and showing that, you know, when the workers aren't safe, food can't keep moving forward. You know, when, you know, like food insecurity rates are so high, we need to kind of put in place other programs to make sure that surplus food is getting to people who need it. So I think my hope is that we have an impetus now to really move something like this forward, some kind of national strategic planning around food.
Oh, it's such a huge area. And in fact, when you mentioned like the 9/11, I think that back after Homeland Security was created, they carved off a chunk of the ag jobs and put them over there, like APHIS, the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service, and some others, which it took them years to figure out how to communicate again, between, let alone Food Drug Administration, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and now Homeland Security, which housed people that used to be in the other agencies. And so it is complex. And I just want to wrap up with a couple of things. I think, first of all, if people would want to see this project that's taking place, where do they find the information about the blueprint?
That is great. So the original blueprint is online. It is, foodstrategyblueprint.org. The website is about to be completely overhauled so that we can launch the update report alongside that, and then some other more bite-sized tools. So there's going to be like a short handout about exactly why Congress can act and what Congress can do. One that's really tailored at the administration, so to make it easier for interested individuals and advocates to actually take those pieces and push them forward. So I will also email you when it's live, and you can maybe share that as a follow-up as well, because we'd love people to engage with it and see it as a shared endeavor, really.
Well, I hear that there's going to be an election this year, and ironically, like only half the parties even came up with a platform this year. And so some of these things that you get, so many things, I think you could have filled up a platform for both parties, but it isn't seeming to happen. But in case there's somebody out there that's in government, state or federal or advisor or committee and so forth, can they reach out to your clinic directly or reach you to say, look, we want to help. We want to jump in. There's going to be conversations about a farm bill coming up. There's going to be some other opportunities. How can we tap this resource that you offer and what you've learned about these directions for food? How do they do it?
Yeah. And we've done projects directly for different government agencies and legislators. So I think this is how we find our projects. We're mostly led by the requests that are coming in, and how can we provide the resources back out. Best way to reach us is FLPC, Food Law and Policy Clinic, at law.harvard.edu. That email is checked by our whole team, so you will get a response. And I think, again, I mean, you know, we're trying to keep the work grounded with how we can move the needle forward. I'd say this blueprint document notwithstanding, which is very big picture and very broad, most of the work is really on, you know, what can be changed in this piece of legislation, or how can this agency put out guidance that unlocks the potential of a regulation that right now no one can read the regulation to even know what they're allowed to do. So that's more of our kind of day-to-day. And I love, people are welcome to reach out and help us stay busy.
Well, a final question I have for you. Now, I really enjoyed having this conversation with you, and you're involved with so many interesting things. And you know, we are discussing this with Professor Emily Broadlieb, and I think, Emily, when you look at where you are today, and if you were going to go ahead, say, 5 years from now, and say, I feel good, I think we've moved the needle, what are the kinds of things that you would hope to be different as a result of your efforts 4 or 5 years down the road?
I love to see the more coordination and recognition of that, you know, we can't address health without addressing food. We can't address the environment without addressing food and agricultural production. So, you know, whether, even if it's not this large scale national dialogue and coordination, but coordination on those issues in particular, I'd love to see the next farm bill in particular. We've been doing a lot of work on the farm bill. I think it's a real moment for us to say, you know, that it is limited in one sense, in that it's really about agriculture, but it sets some national agenda for funding. And I'd love to see some of that going to address some of these issues, like, you know, funding more for workers, for minority farmers, particularly Black farmers who have lost a lot of land. What can we do to get that back? More around linking support for farming with long-term sustainability in a way that goes beyond what we've done thus far. So those are just a handful. I'd say the other, my personal passion is really around reducing food waste. And I think we have a bunch of policies we've looked at that are small changes that could really unlock a lot more, a lot more food going to feed people instead of getting thrown away. So,
well, I think I really respect what you're doing, and I'm sure you're getting some other people and students at the Harvard Law School excited too. And there's a lot of progress that can happen, I think, with the food system in America, and you're going to have your fingerprints on it. You already got your fingerprints on it happening in Canada, so the United States should be next. So, again, I want to thank you for being on Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you so much, Roger. It was so good getting to chat with you.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.